Good morning and welcome to the Monday call. Despite a range of green shoots and positive data points in the real economy, September has been a challenged month for both share markets and fixed income markets in most major economies. This week, we're joined by Mark Brooks, Principal and Senior Portfolio Manager at NZ Funds, to discuss the role different asset classes play, why we are confident a well-diversified and well-constructed portfolio continues to be the right strategy for most investors, talk through how different markets as well as NZ Funds' portfolios have performed, revisit the effect that elections have on returns, and lastly, touch on where we are seeing opportunities in the market and investors deploy their capital. Mark, it's fantastic to have you back. Welcome.
Thanks, Stefan. Morning, everyone.
Good morning. Look, I thought we should start with, why do we invest in shares and fixed income and cash? And what role do each of those different asset classes play in a well-constructed portfolio?
Look, I think that's a great question. And to be honest, one we kind of often forget to come back to as to kind of at its biggest picture is what's our role as fund managers, as investment managers, as an industry, really. And yeah, if I think about the different asset class returns, or even actually be simpler than that, it's really sort of asset returns versus cash. And the default is, yeah, for everyone, myself included, if you're lazy, you end up leaving money sitting in cash. And yeah, the reality is, and especially in an environment, it's a question we're getting a lot now, but in an environment where inflation is higher and is probably likely to be higher, or at least slightly higher tide than we've had over the last sort of 10 years, 15 years pre-COVID, that cash is this real struggle, especially on an after-tax basis, to keep up with inflation and to really grow your wealth. And again, coming back to those simple concepts, if I look back over, say, the life of KiwiSaver, cash, $100 invested in a cash portfolio would have now been worth about $133. If you come back to asset classes, and I'm going to concentrate on shares here because that's really ultimately, the primary asset that people should be using over a longer term to grow their wealth. Broadly, shares, I'll throw property in there because it's often quite similar, but that should be, return 7-8% per annum, should be able to double that $100 every 10 years. And that's why the industry is trying to move people out of cash and get them to invest in assets. The challenge, and I'll sort of talk to it in a second, is really, by doing that, you're looking to grow your wealth over a long period of time. And the importance of that is, that 10 years going from $100 to $200 over 10 years, the next 10 years becomes even more important because then your 200 goes to 400. And for those who have a longer horizon, probably a little younger than myself, or even, I suppose somebody of my age, 30 years going forward, that 400 can become $800. That's eight times your original starting point. You cannot do that in cash. So ultimately the key aim of our entire industry, NZ Funds, Fisher, Milford, any of the other AMP, ANZ, any of the other fund managers in New Zealand, that is ultimately what they're trying to encourage people to do, is invest in assets that can actually grow their wealth over time. The challenge with that is really that, especially investing in shares, is you're moving from, in the extreme, cash, a completely stable asset, to one that moves around a lot in terms of shares. And that can be really challenging, and it is really challenging at the moment where people have had a difficult experience over really what is now probably 3 years. This is a bit of a tangent, but I might sort of take us off on a tangent.
Please.
Looking at some, if we look at academic research, the academic research has this concept of the equity premium puzzle, in the sense of shares, and especially US shares, but it's exactly the same in New Zealand. If you go back through long periods of time, generally shares have done somewhere sort of approaching 10%. So that gives them a real return of about 7% per annum after inflation. And in the US, you know, you can take those numbers back to the early 1920s, and that includes periods, extreme periods like the Great Depression.
And the Second World War.
And yeah, more recently, the 87 crash.
Oil crisis.
The oil crisis, yeah. GFC, COVID. And in New Zealand's example, those numbers are very similar, and it includes, obviously we can't go back as far, but it includes extreme events like the 87 crash in New Zealand, which was really difficult for the share market here because basically we had a very, it's probably the wrong word, but infantile share market at that point. And you know, the academic research sort of says, well, actually those returns are too high, you know, relative to the probability, especially over a 10-year horizon of actually having a getting to that outcome and getting a positive return of that nature. Relative to other asset classes or more stable asset classes, say, such as bonds, they're too high. And economic theory says that people should recognize that and arbitrage it out and actually drive those returns lower.
So just before you move on, when you say arbitrage it out, what does that mean?
Basically, you know, people should see that it's kind of a free lunch, that if they're going to get those returns over the long term that are well above things like bonds, then they should do that to the point that actually they drive the price high that actually brings that return, the annual return, down.
So for an example, just to bring it, I guess, to something that people who aren't in finance can relate to perhaps more easily, if you're buying a house and the house might be $1 million and you're expecting it to go up to $2 million over 10 years, that's a fantastic return.
Yeah.
But if you knew that, if you were confident or had a high degree of confidence that it was going to do that, and there'd been hundreds of years of data to support it, then people would be willing to pay not $1 million, they'd pay $1.5 million for that.
Exactly. And it's interesting, I'll come back to in sort of the discussion with the election later. A lot of market pricing is about what probability people put on different events. And I think if we think through market prices like that, then that helps explain different things. But essentially, you know, make a long story relatively short, what it says is that, you know, the returns are there, but actually there must be something else that is sort of preventing people from, partaking in those returns. And in a New Zealand context, that's really interesting compared to where most people have built their wealth, which is in property, which is an asset class that is not that dissimilar to shares, but it has one big difference in the sense that it is not priced every day and people are not presented with positive or negative returns at a high frequency. And, you know, some of the academic research says that, you know, generally people are loss averse. So given two outcomes that are exactly equal, they will take what they perceive to be the safer option. Or actually, I'll rephrase. If there are two outcomes and one has a better outcome, but it has a chance of loss, people will typically take the safer outcome, even though their expected return of the other is significantly higher.
So just on that, so it might be, for example, you offered a $5, or you could be offered $10 and a 50% chance of getting that $10. The expected return there is the same because you might get $10 or you might get nothing, or you will get $5.
Yeah, or even more extreme, the option may be $20 or zero. And people will often still choose the $5 because they'd rather have that certainty. And, you know, the academic sort of theory says, yes, there is this embedded loss aversion, but also within markets where people see prices more regularly, there often is what you can sort of term a mental accounting. And, you know, people have a tally of what's going on. And there is a point where that sort of ledger, I suppose, gets full. And especially in a negative sense, that if they continue to see negative numbers, it is really difficult for them to stay that course, even though they know that, you know, they are there for a long period of time, and they know that if over a long period of time the data very clearly says that those returns are there to be captured. So I think that's, you know, ultimately that's one of the real challenges our industry has, especially at times like this where, you know, share markets, for example, you know, New Zealand share market has done nothing now for 4 years, where people have seen negative numbers on their accounts. that's the real challenge, is they're presented with those negative numbers regularly, and that becomes a burden. Whereas, and I look at my my own example, obviously the value of our house has gone down significantly over the last 18 months. Have I really thought about that? Because I'm not presented with those numbers. So you don't have that sort of mental accounting that means that you sort of bank away that that impact.
Okay. One question that we often, wrestle with is long period. And what do we mean by long period? Because, well, frankly, when you're young, long period seems like a year or 2 years. But actually, in investment terms, when you're older, it might feel different. But when in investment terms, what do we mean by that?
That's a great question. And I think, the real challenge people have is, it is hard to think beyond really probably a 3-year horizon in many respects. Ask yourself, do you know what you'll be doing in 3 years time? Some people will be able to say that, but it becomes much more uncertain at that point. But the reality is, in terms of investing, as long as people are healthy, often that time frame can still be quite long. If there's somebody is retiring at 65, these days certainly they still have you would expect them to have another 20 years. So coming back to that asset discussion, if they've got $100 at 60, they can turn that into 200 by 70 and potentially 400 by 80. Maybe that allocation might be too aggressive towards that end, but horizon is longer than people expect. So for us, in especially in terms of shares, we would say that the growth portfolios, that's a minimum investment term of 10 years.
Well, one thing that I often find interesting is people think, in the mental accounting space, people think about 65 as this point in time that I need to start thinking about retirement and move to a much more conservative asset allocation. But when confronted with actually reaching that point in their lives, no one, or very, very few, spends all their money on day one. They don't go, and they might look at how they think about their assets differently, but that need to feel secure at that point in time shifts, actually, and there's a longer time horizon in front of them. In fact, a really exciting time horizon in front of them, where they can spend their time in different ways, but it's certainly not withdraw all your KiwiSaver, for example, and go on a big long holiday. That's not what the evidence shows, and it's certainly not what we learn from our clients.
And again, I think it's possibly something because we've had a very long period now of low inflation, it's something that people have tended to diminish in terms of their thinking. Is if we go back to the 70s and periods of very extreme inflation, there are fairly classic, in fact, legal cases where ultimately money was left in cash for long periods of time, and what initially might have been quite a significant sum of cash, say $100,000 in the late 1960s or something, actually became a fairly minimal amount after 10 or 15 years of maybe not rampant inflation, but certainly higher inflation. And as we go forward, we're not believers that inflation is going to be out of control going forward, but we are very much in the camp that structurally there are some changes out there. That's in terms of things like deglobalization. We have had much of the early 2000s was the impulse out of China making things cheaper and easier to get. Very much now there is a process where production has been moved back closer to the consumer. And even if that production is not moving closer, the inventory levels are larger because people want to have that ability to have stuff on hand. So there is a cost to that. And if we look at the decarbonization of the global economy, there is a cost to that, to building wind farms, to building out the electricity networks, all of that process, there is a cost. And lastly, governments generally are spending more money around the world. Governments are running these budget deficits. The electorate is keen and supportive of government spending money. All of those, you know, if you think about demand, all of those are new sources of demand. And the more demand there is, it's likely to keep prices a little higher.
So if you're an investor and you're thinking about, say, you're in New Zealand and interest rates look high and attractive, and yet inflation is also high, how should an investor think about cash and what that actually returns to them?
Always a common and challenging question. I think that ultimately that comes back to that question of horizon. If they have a need for that cash in a relatively short space of time, they're going to buy a house, they have some other specific spending need for it, great place to be. And cash definitely, yeah, is returning you a lot more now than what it has over the last 20 years, I suppose, really, almost. But the challenge in terms of investment market, or in challenge in terms of holding cash, is one, if we have inflation going forward, cash on an after-tax, after-inflation basis is likely to be a low return. Yeah, somewhere probably headline is 5 or even 6%. You've got 3 or 4% inflation. All of a sudden, you're a lot lower, and you're going to lose quite a big chunk of that in tax, especially if you're a trust or a high earner in the 39% bracket. So very difficult to go forward on in real terms. The other one would be that, you know, in terms of why is cash high, ultimately central banks are trying to slow economies in order to get inflation under control. Generally, if we look back through time, they will often, the whole aim is to slow economies. If they are successful, there will be a point where interest rates come down, and those cash rates can actually come down relatively quickly. So by moving out to other asset classes, effectively you look to benefit at that point from either having locked in longer term interest rates through bonds, or actually having shares which have priced in that slowdown already and continue and are able to capture that more positive view when interest rates start to fall.
Righto. So back to that academic article. What did they, or perspective, what did they conclude as to why there was all this money on the table in shares over the long run?
Ultimately, it is that risk aversion, and people struggle and are frankly kind of hardwired to struggle with the volatility and the ups and downs of markets, in the sense that they are showing that price relatively easily and frequently. And to a degree, that's one of the challenges of new technology, is everybody now has an app on their phone which says share market did this, your portfolio did this. Whereas you compare that to property, which again, most people will know that New Zealand property is down sort of, depending on which region, somewhere between sort of 8% and even in the extreme sort of 20% over the last sort of 1 year to year and a half. Have they really been presented with that number that their $1.2 million house is now down $200,000? They don't tend to see that in black and white, so it doesn't come into that mental accounting. So really it does become that sort of that challenge of human emotion and behavior. Okay. But that provides the opportunity, right?
Well, it does. Yeah. I mean, if you're thinking about the future and you're investing, I guess for every transaction there's a seller and a buyer.
So, exactly.
With houses and shares. Okay, so you mentioned earlier the NZX hadn't moved since or gone anywhere, were your words, since 2019. What does that mean, hasn't gone anywhere?
Ultimately, in terms, if we look back through, if we look back through the charts and et cetera, we are able to essentially, if you've been invested in New Zealand shares and represented by the NZX 50 being the top 50 companies in New Zealand, on a total return basis, including the dividends, which are generally sort of 4 or 5% a year, essentially the return since 2019 has been zero. So you're the which has been really challenging, especially when you think about sort of the high quality businesses in New Zealand. Why is that? I'll come back to that in a second. Well, I suppose ultimately, yeah, it's because we've had a slowing economy. And whilst we've had the big move down with COVID, the big move up post-COVID, a lot of that has now been unwound. And, you know, somewhat flippant, I suppose, but, we can kind of take that two ways. One, sort of say, oh, yeah, negative, New Zealand market's gone nowhere for 4 years. Is it worth staying here? The other one is, yeah, we are in a cost of living crisis. Everything's gone up a lot over the last couple of years. Where else can you buy something at 2019 prices? And essentially, that's what you're able to do in New Zealand shares. You'll be able to buy those companies in New Zealand at effectively the same value that they were trading at 4 years ago. That's a real opportunity, I think.
And at the same time, the New Zealand economy has grown through that time. I mean, we've had, on average, 2% or something per year. So over 4 years, that's compound, 9% increase in GDP, give or take. I'm shooting at numbers here, but it's probably about right.
Well, if you look at it, those are real numbers. If you look at it in a nominal, inclusive of inflation, which again, remember, we all want to try and go forward in real terms, but still companies earn nominal dollars. And if we've got 6% inflation, that's 1 or 2% real growth, it still says the economy's growing at 7, even 8% nominal. So actually those companies should be seeing growth.
Yeah, and we've had, populations grown in that time. So there's a lot of supportive factors that don't seem to be reflected, at least today. Harvey Norman's not selling TVs at 2019 prices, unfortunately.
They're not selling too many TVs at the moment, actually.
That's right. Other markets, so have, how do they compare with the gains that we've, in New Zealand, not so much had over that period? We've had some gains and then obviously declines in more recent times. How does the S&P in America compare, and what about other markets?
Yeah, great question, because this year, one of the challenges, I suppose, this year is you've had some quite different returns across share markets. So people sort of say, well, share markets have done well this year. It is really quite dependent about which market you're talking about. And, people very much gravitate to the S&P 500, the major benchmark of the US. And, on the face of it, well, it has, that index has done pretty well. As of last night, it was up 11.9% this year. That's a good return. The two comments I would make to that, again, that comes on the back of a minus 19% last year. So certainly it sort of is balancing a lot of that out. So it had a difficult year last year and it's come back strongly. Also, and we have talked about this before, you've seen quite a difference in terms of the makeup of how that return comes about. So the S&P is what they call a capitalization-weighted index. So the big names make up a larger percentage of that index. So I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but Apple essentially being the largest company is about 6-7% of the index, followed by Microsoft and Nvidia and businesses like that. Big, massive businesses that, ultimately, 5-4% of the index. They tend to dominate that. If you look at what we call an equally weighted index, which takes the S&P 500, so that's 500 companies, we look at each of them with an equal weighting, which is basically 20 basis points, that index is actually marginally down. It's down about 11 basis points this year. So really a lot of that return has, or pretty much the entire return of the US share market has come out of those very large technology companies, which had a very strong start to the year, more recently have given back a bit of return.
So when you say equally weighted, that means equally weighted across the 500 securities.
Correct.
In there.
Yeah.
That is what the index is, what's on the tin. There are 500 companies that they measure. And but say Apple at 6%, that obviously crowds out, if you will, a whole lot of smaller companies in terms of the impact it has on the returns.
Yeah, it probably means that the Yeah, it dominates the return of the bottom 150, maybe even 200 stocks within the index. Massively overpowers that.
What a beast it is.
Yeah, and if you go across, I suppose we are guilty of this a bit. Yeah, our clients have a diversified global exposure. We often talk about the US market because it's sort of front and center. It's a monster market. But if we go through a number of the others, you can see some quite different returns. Yeah, staying with the US, if I look at sort of the Dow Jones, which is a more mature index, I suppose, for the right word, less tech orientated. Yeah, that's up 1%. The Russell 2000, which is more small companies, that again is up sort of 1.5-2%. If I go to the UK, 2% again. One that's done particularly well this year is actually Japan. The Japanese market's up 22% this year. So you have some very different returns. And unfortunately, if we come down this part of the world, returns are a bit more anemic as well. Australia is up 3.5% this year. Okay. And New Zealand is actually down closer to that number, sort of down 2.6. So again, it's been very much returns have been quite market dependent. And unfortunately, that sort of has actually, in a diversified portfolio, which our clients have, that's tended to be reflected, that the returns have been closer to those those zero and negative numbers than they have in the strength of the S&P.
And yet we do hold across portfolios weightings to and participate in technology security, shares that have gone up, your Apples, your Amazons, Videos and so forth. So in a diversified portfolio, there's definitely a strong allocation to them, particularly through our third-party managers, Fisher Investments out of the US, and MFS, who actually recently both been on the Monday call.
Yes, exactly.
Fantastic. So shares, though, as you mentioned earlier, we expect them to deliver over the long run 7% real returns. And so what's important there is that you keep an eye on the long term and say, well, this is, it's been in some markets, it's been a difficult period, New Zealand obviously being one since 2019. But across the, across a diversified portfolio, they will deliver through time.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, again, the challenge is that day to day, week to week, year to year volatility. But if in terms of returns, the longer the return period you have, the more likely you are to actually meet that 7% number. It sort of becomes the funnel that moves down to the volatility. Over a very short period of time is high. The volatility actually reduces a lot the longer you're in that that asset.
And at the same time, the benefit of compounding takes
exactly. Effect. And again, we didn't really touch on it before, but ultimately, that's another way of expressing what our industry does. It's trying to bring people into assets that have a higher return that can capture compounding. And that's really the untold secret that we should be teaching, in schools. That is as important as reading and writing, as understanding compound. If you own an asset over a long period of time, it doesn't really matter what that asset is, but if you own that asset that is going to go up in value, it will compound.
What did Buffett call it? The eighth wonder of the world?
Something like that, yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so bonds don't compound, though.
They do, but at a less degree.
A much smaller degree. take us through how you're thinking about that fixed income market at the moment and what inflation and interest rates in the US particularly are telling investors.
Yeah. A bit of a challenging year ultimately for bonds this year. The nice aspect is that we are still getting, interest rates are at the highest years, the highest level they've been for a very long time. Sort of overnight, the US 10-year, I think, sort of touched sort of 465, which is, the highest for a very long period of time. The nice thing about that is you go back again 2 years, you were getting 1-2% yield. Now your starting point for a risk-free asset, at least in terms of default, is 4.5-5%. If you're looking at corporate bonds, you're getting another 1% or 1.5%, depending on the nature of the asset, above that. So you're getting that 6% number, et cetera. And very much that's the case of the bonds we hold in our portfolios. Yeah, they have a yield for us of 6 or even 7% in some cases. The challenge over the shorter term has been that those interest rates have kept moving higher, isn't it? Ultimately, the market has continued to reduce the probability of recession and certainly price out the probability of deep recession. And as a result, interest rates have really just, a bit like a tide, have continued to move higher this year. And that has really weighed on returns. And if I look through sort of, bond market returns this year, sort of somewhere between, depending on which market you look at, somewhere between about -3% and +3%. So it's been really that capital impact, which is more of a short-term thing, has weighed on it. The flip side would be that, holding bonds at this point, one, you are getting that starting point of owning an asset which has a strong yield, but actually they provide that, they allow you to lock in that yield. So once we get to a point where economies have slowed enough and central banks start to reduce rates, and they will at some point, it's a question of how far out that is and how low those rates go, but at some point they will, bonds will benefit from that. And I think one, for those who may have been able to read, I think one of our commentaries last month, the August month, was that if you look at the last couple of cycles in New Zealand, and I'll get these numbers wrong. Wait for the fire trucks to leave outside. I'll get these years wrong, but in terms of sort of the last cycles, which I think was 2014 and 2007, in those periods, if you held bonds for the 2 years after that, they actually gave you returns much closer to share markets, mainly because interest rates move lower and that capital impact of holding a much higher yield to start with, you got the benefit of that as competing interest rates fell. And that capital came back into those value of those bonds. So their price went up.
Investors often find it difficult to understand the way
bonds work.
When they go up, when interest rates go up, bonds go down. And the inverse is true too. So it's a tricky one to wrap your head around if you're not looking at it day to day.
Correct.
Needless to say, when you're buying a bond now, because interest rates are higher, the return on your bond is generally better than what it was 2, 3, 4 years ago.
Much better. I think night and day ultimately.
And the role a bond plays as a diversifier, as a genuine diversifier in a portfolio. So you'll see at NZ Funds in almost all of our portfolios, we use what we call a life cycle or a glide path approach to our most investing. And so a bond's and inflation protected or focused assets are in effectively all of our portfolios. The role that they play is to diversify and provide a better risk adjusted return through time, which if you're purely invested in shares, will be more high octane, but you're not getting the benefits of diversity, which is one of the few free lunches in finance.
Exactly.
Okay. We always get questions on this, so I'd be remiss not to touch on it. Digital assets, crypto, Bitcoin, where is that at? And how are you thinking about it within the portfolios at NZ Funds and more generally as an asset class?
Yep. Great question. And I think, in terms of thinking about it as an asset class, I would ultimately see it as a diversifier. And as we go forward, I think, we've seen this period over the last couple of years where very much it was in fashion asset, very much a risk asset, went up a lot, came down a lot. Really what's been interesting over the last probably year now is it has tended to act more like a lot of the theory says it should be, in the sense of a bit like, especially in the case of Bitcoin, a bit more like a digital gold. And why do I sort of say that? Ultimately, gold as a store of value is because it's relatively, the supply of gold is pretty limited. In the extreme, the supply of Bitcoin is limited. There is a fixed number of Bitcoins out there. So as an asset class, it's a very interesting diversifier, I think, going forward. And you know, what has been probably pleasing this year is that it has tended to walk to its own its own beat, and it has tended, to ignore, when share markets have moved up, it's ignored that. Equally, when share markets have moved down, it's kind of ignored that. So it suggests it is doing something different. I think, what makes us, the other thing that makes us interested in it at this point is, it is still a relatively small market. And this is, quite similar with, say, something like commodities. And small markets, when demand increases, does tend to give you the marginal buyer in shares doesn't have a lot of impact because they're massive markets. If markets move their attention to commodities, they can drive commodity prices a long way. If markets turn their attention to crypto, I think they can move that market quite a long way. And why I sort of say that is if you look at what's holding back to a degree Bitcoin at present is the regulatory structure in the US. And you've seen a number of sort of court cases where the SEC is taking various businesses to court, ultimately for offering crypto as a security. Without being too flippant, a lot of that is actually a turf war in the US. The SEC, as their name suggests, the Securities and Exchange Commission, their role is to regulate securities. If crypto is considered a security, that comes under their remit, that makes their cake bigger. So a lot of that is about that process. But I think what is really interesting is if you think about the demand and supply is not changing. Demand, if you're sitting as a financial advisor in America at one of the massive businesses at Fidelity or Charles Schwab or something like that, it is very difficult for you to recommend a crypto asset. And if we go the step forward where there is an ETF and the SEC signs off on an ETF, and certainly BlackRock, the world's largest asset manager, is pushing for that. They want a crypto ETF. I would expect that once that tick comes, and it will come soon, that actually those advisors at Charles Schwab, at Fidelity, et cetera, will be able to put a small portion, 50 basis points, 1% of their client money into crypto. That is quite a lot of demand, which is positive for that space.
Interesting. And the language that gets used around Bitcoin and digital assets more generally, but particularly Bitcoin and Ethereum, has changed over the last couple of years. It used to be viewed very much as a speculator's asset class. It had returned fabulously, and there were, I guess, lots of groupies who really loved it and put a lot of energy into it. But more recently, the language has changed, and people view it much more as a genuine diversifier. Is it what's driving that shift in perception?
I'm not sure, is the honest answer. Maybe just time. Again, I think, I've expressed this before, I kind of view crypto at the present as a bit like the sort of post-dot-com bubble in tech shares. You kind of knew the internet was a big thing. You didn't really know how it would change our life. Is crypto going to be as large as that? That's open for debate, but it's going to be around, I think. And as a result, it does seem that those assets, if they're around, there is a case for them, and especially if they're doing something different to other major asset classes. So I think over time, people have just become more comfortable with it, ultimately. Yeah. It takes time to get used to new things.
It does. Speaking of new things, let's move on to the election, which is a hot topic. How do elections, just stepping at a sort of a very, very high level helicopter view of the world and financial markets, how do elections interact with asset prices, if at all?
Really good question. And I think about, for me, it's about how do markets come up with prices is probably the right way to think about it, in the sense that, ultimately, what is a market price? It's really a collection of people's expectations. If you're really, back to our sort of comment about house prices earlier, if you're really positive about the future and you're very certain that the future is going to be good, you're going to be willing to pay up for something. because you're discounting you're putting a very low probability on bad outcomes. You're going to be quite bullish. Conversely, if you think the world's falling in, you're going to put a high, you know, falling into a hole, you're going to put a high probability on negative outcomes. And that's why markets often lurch massively in one direction or another when there's these big events, because ultimately people all of a sudden change the probability they place on outcomes. That's the way I sort of think about elections, because yeah, you can realistically in New Zealand, the two major parties are not particularly different. They're not radically different. So from my point of view, I think, yeah, definitely it is always human nature that people hold off from doing things ahead of elections just because there's a degree of uncertainty. They want some certainty, especially if they sort of think, well, I need to make this decision. It's an important decision, but actually, will it waiting 2 months really make a difference? Yeah, you know, from that point, they will hold off. So there is a reticence to do things. But if we think about that probability structure, it's kind of hard to see a particularly different outcome in terms of the probabilities of the two major parties. Certainly, if you got a massive landslide to Green, which made the wealth tax a highly likely probability, that would change that probability distribution. I think you'd see quite a large change in market prices. But yeah, it would seem that at this point, that's not a high probability outcome.
No, I mean, the two major parties are indeed so incredibly similar that it's almost hard to know what the differences are. I don't know if you saw the leaders' debate the other night where they did a rapid fire series of questions, and they both, Hipkins and Luxton, had the same question answer for everything except for one point. It did leave you wondering what's the point of democracy in that moment. But anyway.
In a nutshell, I'm pretty relaxed about the outcome of the election. I think the other way to think about it is, what are the companies you're buying? What are the big companies in New Zealand? You think about your Meridians, Chorus, Contact, even Fletcher Building. Does their business dramatically change, or even, you know, does it change a bit based on the outcome of the election? Possibly for the property companies, the listed property businesses with issues around the treatment of depreciation, yes, you can argue that. But for a Meridian or a Contact Energy or a Spark, their business is not going to change.
Some people think that there's going to be a relief rally of sorts as a more pro-business mindset that National advocates for will be felt across the business community. How do you think about that in terms of probabilities?
I think it's probably, again, coming to that back to that point that people hold off from doing things. So I think you just see that sort of, you know, stuff gets put into action again. It is certainly, given the New Zealand market hasn't gone anywhere for a long period of time, it's probably primed for that sort of event. But okay, we'll see. We're not placing new positions based on that outcome.
Fantastic. All right, last one for me is just the New Zealand economy, real economy, was revised out of recession the other day. Didn't get as much fanfare as the labelled as in recession. Not surprising there. We weigh our views to the downside, it seems, as humans. Take us through what's driving a more solid economy, both in New Zealand and in the States. And there'll be different factors, but where's that coming from?
Yeah. Look, I think one of, to a degree, we've called this wrong, and I think we're not alone in this, is generally most have been fairly surprised that, around the world you've had, this the Reserve Bank of New Zealand raised interest rates more than 5%. It's done the same in the US, and actually in the US it was much faster over a shorter period of time. But it really doesn't, economies have slowed, but they haven't really slowed to the same degree that many would have expected. And certainly, they're not in recession, which would, you'd generally expect given that speed of interest rate rise should have been the case. Why has that happened? I think in retrospect, a number of factors. Ultimately, personal balance sheets. People had money in the bank. They came through COVID pretty well. Yeah, much of that, or a lot of that at times, was thanks to government action and, you know, things like the wage subsidy, etc. So people still were getting paid, even if they couldn't work. They couldn't spend on things. So basically they built up a bit of a war chest. So that created that, definitely created that buffer in terms of, you know, having activity. I think the other one is in New Zealand, you've actually seen more people working and actually you've seen wage rises come through. So if I look at sort of household income, similar in the US, household income has risen. And in New Zealand's case, it's been up to sort of close to 10% per annum. So really that has been that buffer against the against inflation and against those higher costs. And probably the last one is that, yeah, to a degree, there's, you know, some of those interest rate impacts have just taken more time to come through the economy than probably we'd expect. The lags are longer. Actually, on the last one I haven't touched on here is in New Zealand, we've got more people. And you are seeing that in things like some of the retail sales numbers. You know, retail sales at a total level are up, but actually, if you took away the number of people, definitely down.
So it's immigration driving it.
Yeah.
Fantastic. At least there's some great positive. Part of the book, good positive, you know, impulse in the economy. But obviously that will put pressure on interest rates. And so we'll see how it plays out. Thank you very much, Mark. It's been a really, really good session today. I've appreciated your insights. I guess my big takeout, which I hope listeners also take from it, is the importance of a diversified portfolio and how through time that will deliver over and above other asset classes.
Exactly.
Great.
Cool. Thanks, everyone.
This has been The Monday Call, brought to you by NZ Funds. New Zealand Funds Management Limited is the issuer of the NZ Funds KiwiSaver Scheme, the NZ Funds Managed Superannuation Service, the NZ Funds Advised Portfolio Service, the NZ Funds Wealth Builder, and NZ Funds Income Generator. A product disclosure statement for each is available at nzfunds.co.nz. Past performance is not necessarily an indicator of future returns.